So we covered in part one of risk management a whole lot of waffling from me about your general approach and philosophy. In this one, I want to talk a little bit more about some examples of risks and issues. And then I hope that we can kind of branch off, as I tend to, and talk about a whole bunch of things around that. What I'm hoping is that at the end of this section, we can then go on to some screen work where I show you some actual work being done in which I put together some risks and some issues, and you can see me working through it and thinking through it, and I'll talk through what my thinking is, and I'll simulate some conversations which I've had to say, oh, well, I talked to this person, that person, they said this, they said that, and that's what we're going to do about it, just to show you the thought process and to reinforce the whole process around risks and issues and how best to handle them. So, enough rambling. You'll forgive me, I'll look at my notes a few times. So, before we do that, you should note, I'm coming at you as someone who's been working outside of the games industry for quite a while and who's got coffee. Cheers. Project management, risk management, etc., which is part of project management. This isn't something that in the other industries that use risk management that people have got right. This is hard. There's a reason that you've got a job. You're not employed because you're good at smiling at people and having a laugh. You're employed because this is difficult and people deserve your help. They deserve being respected by you enough that you want to fix their problems. And I hope that's an adequate boost to your motivation to actually study risk management a little bit closer and think about it a little bit more. So let's look at high-level risks. A high-level risk is one which probably has come down to you from on high. So your bosses may have said to you something like, well, as part of our development strategy for this game, we need you to come in a year faster, or you really need to be ready for E3, which will require you to throw aside everything you're working on and commit the entire team to making a trailer of a game that probably doesn't exist in reality, or maybe it's gameplay footage, in which case you need to have the gameplay ready for that footage to be recorded, for example. Or it might be something far more fundamental, such as at the end of an 18-month period, you will lose half of your team. So, say, half of the design team. So you need to be able to finish the work they're doing in time, and you need to be able to move them off in time. And why is that? It's because we have another project, we have another game, or whatever it is. It might be something more fundamental, such as if we don't get this game out on time, we're going to go bust, or whatever. Or for us to get bonuses from the publisher, these milestone deadlines are immovable, and that's that. And you can argue they're impossible. Okay, you still need to make it happen. Now, that kind of unhigh risk still needs to be recorded. You still need to say, this is a risk. We can bring it up at leadership team meetings and we can discuss what we're going to do about it. At the very least, just by recording it and having it there and making it visible, no one can say that it was a surprise. And you'll find that sometimes in leadership meetings that you're not going to go over the same thing every week. You're going to pick on specific things where you're making some progress. But you still need to be aware of them. You still need to think about it and talk about it. So these high-level risks, they are your strategic risks. They're the ones which you can chuck in an Excel spreadsheet and work through. But they tend to be more long-term, something coming along in a year, 3 months, 3 years. Depends on the game. Depends what you're making. If you're making a mobile game, it could be that there's a big change coming to, say, the way that a particular games platform is going to market your game, or a way of a big change to user acquisition that you need to know about. It depends. If it's a small indie, you might find it difficult to have strategic risks if you're only a tiny indie, but still, you're going to have them. And they're probably going to be really real, like, we will run out of money, or the publisher will want this milestone, really, really, really good vertical slice, and if we don't deliver it, they'll shut us down. So I think it's interesting that the bigger the studios, and the huger they are, the less urgent some of these bigger risks look, because you're part of something huge. But that's not really true, because they're still going to happen. Just like everyone's going to die one day, they're still going to happen. And you don't want your little baby game to die, so you need to take them seriously. Staffing. So staffing is always an issue, because people come and go. And that's actually fine. It's fine that people move around the games industry or leave it and come back, like I did. It's fine. They gain experience. Some people don't fit. Some people do. Some people just want to change. But let's say your head of design leaves. You're screwed. What are you going to do? You need to find a replacement. People will say, well, we'll promote the person who was under them. And you'll say, well, I'm not sure they're ready. Well, you know, people aren't always ready. You need to chuck them in there before they're ready so they can prove themselves. True, yeah, okay, we can try that. Problem solved. But if we move them up, who's going to be the deputy then? Well, maybe we don't need one, and so on and so forth. You need to have those conversations, to be sure. But really, you need to be thinking, let's look at the structure. Let's look at the team structure, the team dynamic. Let's talk to the head of design. What do they think should happen? How are we going to keep going with minimum disruption? How long have I got until they leave? What are we going to do with this information? How are we going to communicate it? What are we going to say to the team members? Maybe it's a secret for a while. Maybe it isn't. How do we handle this? But really, while you are kind-hearted enough to think about that, and while you are also thinking about the morale of your team and how you're going to finish the things that only your head of design knew anything about, etc., while you're thinking about that sort of thing, you should be thinking about, right, in 3 months' time, how is it going to look? How will this have fundamentally changed anything else? Who else do I need to talk to? Do I need to talk to the head of art? Do I need to talk to QA? Do I need to go and find out what state things are in, which they've told me, the head of design's told me the states, but I'm not quite sure I'm really convinced. You need to go and investigate. You need to go and make yourself comfortable that you can answer questions that will come from others. Because when an important person in the team leaves, it leaves a gap of knowledge. And it leaves, for the good ones, it will leave a whole bunch of momentum, motivation, support that they've been offering to others, especially with senior people. So you need to be mindful of all of that. And people will be scared when important people leave. It's a risk. Now, if they're definitely leaving, it becomes an issue. They're leaving. So make it an issue, not a risk. If you've heard that somebody might leave, put it in as a risk. See if you can save them, if you want to save them, from leaving. Sometimes you don't, right? They don't fit. It's good for them to make a move somewhere else. But staffing is a big issue. Now, that's just an individual. I've had situations where we've been working on games and I've suddenly been told, here are 10 artists that you need to find jobs for because we need to pay them. So give them some work to do. Okay, what kind of artists are they? Oh, we don't know. Go and find out. Right. Okay. So what we really need are environment artists. Yeah, I think they're concept. Right. Okay. That's another risk, right? Or an issue in this case. That large groups of people can appear or disappear. And staffing, you need to think about very carefully. Staffing's a really difficult issue because as a risk or an issue, you need to justify that you need the people. And sometimes you don't. And you need to justify that you need specific skill sets in a person at a specific level of expertise or experience or both. You may need a very specific AI programmer. You might need somebody who is, say, incredible at, I don't know, Unreal. You might need a technical artist. Tech artists have specific skill sets. What kind do you need? You might need a concept artist at the beginning, short term, and then you might need to get rid of them, right? Where it is obvious and known and simply part of making a game and it's part of the game delivery life cycle, you don't have to raise it as a risk or an issue. It's where it comes out of the boundaries. It's where it becomes something that's stepped over and you go, hang on, that doesn't feel right. Something's going to happen here. Well, I need to fix that. That's when you need to raise risks and issues. So with staffing, typical examples, I've given you some. People catching wind that somebody's really unhappy and is going to leave and they're one of your key personnel. You could raise it as a risk and issue. You might just want to go and have a chat with them first and find out what's really going on. But at some point, people who walk up to you and say, oh, please don't tell anybody about this. It's secret. I'm going to leave next week. And they happen to be an incredibly important person on your team. You're going to tell someone else. You're not going to keep it as a secret. Obviously, there are times when it really is obvious that you could not possibly tell anyone else. But if it's just, oh, I'm a bit unhappy and I'm definitely going to leave, I've got another job, you have a responsibility to tell some people in confidence, because otherwise they can't do anything about it. You have to. You are accountable. You have to as a producer. You cannot just keep something a secret because someone's asked you to sometimes. Make a judgment call. Because in 6 months' time, if things have gone up shit creek because that person's left, and you know very well that if you'd said something, you could have at least assuaged some of that pain. Schedule budget management. Depends upon the level that you're at, but let's go over budget management first. What's a budget? Now, believe it or not, a budget's just an estimate. A budget's just a finger in the air, stab in the dark. We reckon we probably need this many people, and we think we need them to be these people. And you'll find that a budget normally for people will have names of people. It might just have skill set types, categories of people. It depends. But the budget against those people will take into account their location, whether they're a contractor or permanent or freelance or whatever you have in your country where you're working. It will have how much they are and add it all up, and that will be your budget for people. But your budget will also have, depending upon your level of seniority, you might be exposed to things like CapEx, OPEX, so operating costs and capital expenditure and all this sort of stuff. You might have to take into account hardware costs and licenses. And if a member of staff walks up to you and says, I need this license for this cool thing and we can do this amazing stuff. And you go, oh, go and get it then. Oh, by the way, how much is it? It's $10,000 a month. Yay. Well, that could be the cost of a person. And often you'll find that you're in this zero sum world, as they say, in which you're trading off things, and you could be trading off people. And there's no real winner. The more that you want to give, the more you have to give back somewhere else. And that's life. But it's a risk if you have a budget which has, one would hope, an upper ceiling of how much you're able to spend. And that money, if you're accountable for it, or even a portion of it, if it looks like you're going to go over or under, you need to raise that. Back to risks and issues, specifically about schedule and budget management. The most common one is not, unfortunately, that you'll be given too much money. It tends to be that the most common one is that you're suddenly told you don't have that money anymore and that you need to get rid of some people. And then you raise that as a risk and you talk to the senior staff and you make your decisions. But that's an example. And cutting corners and cutting money, that's life. That's what happens. Schedule. So schedule and risks, I mean, they go together, right? They're pretty much hand in hand with each other. A schedule. What is a schedule? It's supposed to be a list of work to do in a certain order. And if you were to extrapolate upwards, you'd find yourself with a roadmap. And your roadmap would be a work of fiction as you stare into the crystal ball of the future and say, what do we think a roadmap might look like? What do we think we're achieving in terms of our vision being broken down into our features and our you know, the different pillars of the game? What are we going to look at here? And in 6 months' time, will we have achieved a minimum viable product, a proof of concept? In 6 months' time, will we be in production? Will we have shipped, if we're going to ship? What will we look like? Now, a roadmap, whether people like it or not, is a work of fiction, because it presumes that estimates that have been made about work are correct and that you know everything, that you have 100% prescience and knowledge about the future, which you do not. So a roadmap should always be sold as a fluid piece of fiction in which you're aiming at these things. Whereas your schedule is your schedule of work. It's what are the people in my team doing? What is my team doing? Are we making this game in a certain way? Great. How's that going? What's the list of work? Has that been broken down properly? Have people thought about that if somebody else over there is doing that work, it might hold up the people over there? Is a dependency. But the schedule, and where it comes into risks, is, well, it's based upon what you're trying to make. And you might not know what you're trying to make. This is game development, after all. There's a fun factor. There's a great potential that you might go down the wrong rabbit hole. You might spend too long on a proof of concept for a feature which is terrible because you just can't get it to work. You might have to throw away an entire game level which you thought was going to be the best level ever because you just can't make it work. Why can't you make it work? I don't care. The fact is, some really, really good people have been trying. You have to say the schedule's foobar. We cannot now produce that feature or that level or whatever it is. We're delayed elsewhere. We're going to have to rethink. It's going to push us back. We're going to have to suddenly think, what are all these people going to be doing with their time when they were expecting to be, say, arting a level that doesn't exist? So it's an issue. It's happening. You don't have to raise a risk to say it might happen unless it becomes really likely. If there's a big piece of work going on, and I've definitely raised this as risks before, where there's a proof of concept for a specific feature or a specific really major piece of level that you're kind of resting your hopes on. Maybe it's a particular type that you really need in the game to fulfill certain criteria. You raise that as a risk. You say, this has to work. And if it doesn't work, we need a plan B. And you should start talking about a plan B. So schedule risks, budget risks, they are part of life. They are high level, but they're part of life. And you need to get used to the fact that they require a great deal of your time and effort and stress levels. I've got no hair. That's pretty much because of budget and schedule. So the next one, inadequate specification. So if you're working on a game, you realize that it's funny to think that you're going to get adequate specification of what a game's going to be. And it's different in some cases, right? With smaller mobile games and with smaller indies where you know exactly what, say, you're cloning or you know exactly what you need to produce. It's very much a time-boxed piece of work where you can just say, right, this is what we're doing, let's get it out there. That's fine. You can probably get an adequate specification for that in terms of a scope and in terms of the specific type of game, the specific work, the specific check boxes you need to tick, you know. But normally, for a larger game with more people, you're going on an adventure, you're exploring. And when you're exploring, you're not going to get adequate specification for everything. What you are going to get, though, with good teams, is you're going to get things like the head of engineering or the code leader, whatever you call them, the principal programmer, whoever. That person there is probably going to give you a whole bunch of advice on what you can expect your, say, tech spec limits are. So they're going to say, well, we're looking at launching on this console over here and on PC, and we're looking, therefore, that this stuff you want to do over here that's really amazing, yeah, you can do that. That stuff over there, forget it. You're never going to be able to pull that off if you want to get, if you're going to want to hit 60 frames per second, just no chance. So you can start building up that picture if you can inform people on where you're going to put a game in the first place. You know, there's a big difference between certain platforms, there's a big difference between what people can and can't use. And they should know that from the start. Otherwise, you got no game. But in some cases, tech specs, particularly with like the next gen consoles that are appearing, a lot of that's going to be trial and error, and you're going to hypothesize. Also, technical specifications. When you are trying to estimate how much load on a, say, a computer, on a gaming PC, your game's going to be in the end, you're guessing. I mean, you can base it upon a lot of experience, and there are definitely ways of measuring load, etc. But when you keep piling in artwork and piling in all this great stuff you want to do and piling in more and more, piling in, that could end up being a big issue, because you could end up going, oh, well, we've shoved so much into this level, if it's a level that you're designing, it doesn't really run anymore. It runs at such a crappy frame rate that we've realized there's an entire bunch of features that we're just not going to be able to support. There's an issue right there. And when you see it coming, there's a risk. So it's worth actually raising forms of specifications as risks early on, because then it encourages you to keep thinking about them and discussing them, to get people in a room and talk through, well, when do we think we're going to know more? Really, in concept, you might find that there's not much you can do. You're not that interested. By the time you're trying to exit pre-production, if that's what you happen to have, if those are the phases that you're going through, you really should have a much clearer idea, because you don't want people hacking out huge amounts of content for your game and then telling them, oh, sorry, do you think you could reduce the polygon count? So there's that kind of specification. There are loads of other kinds of specifications, though. There's things like, I mean, I just mentioned art, but there are things like the style guides and the templates and the guidance you're going to get. If you're a new artist starting somewhere and you're told, right, hey, here you go. Here's what you need to know about the art here. And some of that stuff is going to change. Some of that stuff, you're just going to have to be talking about it, and you're going to have to be aware that as you get on with the game and as people get more and more ambitious and as people work harder and harder, the day could come that the tech artist walks up to you and says, that plugin that we've been using over there, that's disappearing next month. It's not being supported anymore. We can't use it. Or, hey, you know that bloke who was using that thing over there? You know that? And how it's fundamental to a part of the game? We just realized we don't have a commercial license for it, and it's going to be $1 million. Can we afford it? Stuff like that's going to happen, right? Best thing is, you can raise it as an issue. You can log it. You can look at the impact. Right, write it down, be communicative, be transparent. The dreaded fun factor. It's the bane of my life, the fun factor. Have you found the fun yet? Yeah, but is it fun? Yeah, but guys, we're looking at this demo of this level, and none of us really think it's fun, do we? So what are you going to do to make it fun? It's the whole walking up to the art director and saying, could do with being a bit bluer, couldn't it? So you need to be careful with the fun factor. I say it's the bane of my life. I'm semi-serious. Why is it the bane of a producer's life? It's because it illustrates that making a game is a journey into chaos. And no project methodology handles chaos, because chaos is a transitory state where you try and pull order from it. And you can't do that with project management. Project management says, we need to make this thing, and to make it, we'll do this. Now, some people will be throwing plates at me because they'll say, oh, agile project management. There's no such thing as agile project management. There are no projects in agile. Agile doesn't deal with finite projects. Agile deals with products. Agile deals with quite different things. The term agile project management is a misnomer. So anyway, that's important, because when you look at the fun factor, what you're really looking at is an admission that we are allowing a whole bunch of adults to play around for a long time in order to discover something brilliant by working together. And that brilliance takes the forms of these amazing games that go out. And it's a miracle. And it's wonderful. It's like an incredible painting that's painted by a dozen artists or 200 artists. It's incredible that it can ever work. But it works, but it's not very ordered. Now, we need to, as producers, support that chaos, but also have boxes around the chaos. It can't go on forever. People can't be allowed to just play in their toy box forever. The sandbox will eventually be closed along with the studio if you don't get something out. Agile, lean, those kind of methodologies in the form of lean startup, in the form of agile scrum, for example, these describe ways of handling very chaotic projects. So say chaotic software development, or should I say complex. So agile scrum is for complex work. Lean software development is for more ordered software development, but still can handle things being tits up. These days, when you work as a producer, I pretty much guarantee you're a scrum master, right? You've probably got qualifications as a scrum master. You probably don't as a product owner, and you probably were given a basic foundation course in agile, but your team probably wasn't, but are now expected to be agile. Why? It's because, well, why are they expected to be agile? It's because agile product development works on iterative and incremental cycles. Iterative in that it says, we will very quickly see if something works and we will put it in front of the customer. Let's say you're using Scrum. Let's say your Scrum team every 2 weeks put something in front of the customer. You will always try and have a working product every 2 weeks, let's say. And by doing that, you can't go too badly off the line, because your customer, who's probably the person paying you, can say, well, that's not what I wanted. You've made a bike. I wanted a scooter. What the hell? But you can get to these problems quickly, right? There's a cycle. There's an increment. Let's say it's 2 weeks. Let's say it's 3 weeks. So there's a whole mass of work around agile methodology and philosophy that says, by doing things this way, you're actually just embracing a very old-fashioned concept. It's not that new, to be honest. It's the old-fashioned concept of learning, right? So if you are a self-learner and you've ever done courses in cognitive learning, you'll know that this cycle of looking at something, thinking about it, adapting, changing it a little bit, trying again, that cycle of learning, which says, let's try it out. Let's see if it's the right idea or not. That's basically what Agile took and works around. It goes, there is a cycle, and Lean does the same. There is a cycle of product development that says, let's keep it short so that we don't go way over there for years and then bring out something which is crap. Because that's stupid. That's waterfall. That's the idea that you plan everything in advance, and then because you know exactly what you're doing, and then you bring it out in the future and it's great. It's a catastrophic failure, but you still see it in game development. Because what you get is the teams are told, be agile, be scrum, be iterative, be incremental, discover fun fast, fail fast, blah, blah, blah. But at the top level, the bigwigs are all still saying, oh yeah, but where's our design documents? I want you to plan everything out to the nth degree. If you don't plan everything out, then the coders won't know what to code and the artists won't know what to art. So, hey, designers, where's our design document? Why haven't you written it all up? Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm saying you need to be mindful of the agile philosophy that says working software over documentation. We favor working software over documentation. It doesn't say don't do any. It says keep it balanced so that you can actually show something rather than show documents. Now, I've been in places where documentation has ground all kinds of leadership and development to a halt. Agile is one way to avoid over-documenting. Why is that a problem? Because if you document everything at the beginning and you're making a game in which you're trying to discover things and find the fun, you haven't embraced the chaos. You've tried to put order in the chaos too quickly. It's important to put some order in, and it's important to have a concept, and it's important to have design, art people, etc., working together with their coders, working together with QA, working together with everybody else in audio and going, right, this is the general idea of what we're doing, but we're still discovering. And Agile and Lean, they support discovering. So you can have a discovery phase. You can actually discover things. And you're not scared of change. You embrace it. You say, it's fine. We have this concept. You know where we're at now? We're at here. And it was still within technical limitations. It was still within a bunch of specifications. This is still risk and issue because you can highlight these things. You can say, it's all very well finding the fun, but our risk is if we don't get this particular thing here to the state of fun, and I'm being slightly facetious when I say it like that, but you know what I mean, then we're going to fail in other areas. And this really is very sensible because you're going to have milestones. You're going to have deadlines. And you need to be able to draw the short, focused view that is many agile teams. And you need to be able to say, there's a bigger world. And in the bigger world, we need a vertical slice ready next month. How are you doing? Are you not ready? You're still trying to find the fun? Oh, well, we're screwed, aren't we? That's a risk. That's an issue, whatever. Now, by raising a risk and saying, we have 3 months to deliver this thing, it forces you and the people around you at a leadership level to keep that in mind, to keep thinking about it, to keep pressing and pushing and motivating and driving and directing. So people in charge need to direct. They need to say, try this or that. It didn't work, shelve it, try something else. It helps you to do that. Change management in the games industry. I've never ever worked anywhere which has had change management. I have worked outside of the games industry where there has been huge amounts of governance in places like pharmaceutical industry and the local governments and the foreign office in the UK, which have had change management. What is change management? It's a part of project management. Change management says you can't just change things. You need to go through a process. We need to monitor the change. We need to assess the change. We need to evaluate the change. We need a chance to have a little think about this change that you wanted to make, because this change could fundamentally alter a whole bunch of things and could have a spill-on effect. There are change managers out there. Change management, not just about change to something you're working on, but it could be that what you're delivering changes the way people think, work. It could make their job invalid, you know, outside of the games industry. It could be that you're working on improving processes, and as a result, 10 people over there will lose their jobs because they won't need them anymore because we're automating things. And you need change management in place to say, well, what's our change plan? How are we going to communicate that? People just change things and they don't tell each other. So really for you, it's just about communication again and transparency. It comes back to that again. We're going to change a level. We're going to change this bit of the game. We're going to change how high this thing here can jump with these controls. Oh, are you? Well, did you know if you change that, we have to remake the whole game? It's things like that, right? It's where something changes and you need to do something about it to communicate across, or something's about to change and you need to go, oh God, or it's changed and you need to roll it back. You will find QA is your massive ally here because they'll spot those changes first. And the number of times that someone quite innocently changes a thing and doesn't understand the impact is extraordinary. For example, your lighting person, she sat there at 8 o'clock at night. She's waiting to light a scene. And she goes, oh, thank God, I can finally light this scene. Everything's been checked in. She comes in the next day. And the first thing that happened was somebody logged in, checked in a new change. Eight, nine in the morning. She comes in at 10 o'clock. She has to do the lighting again. Is that change management? Kind of. It's managing the change. It's about communication. It's about respect. It's about teaching people what they can and can't do. It's about educating them on what happens when they make changes like that. It's not official change management. If you did a project management course and learned about change management, it might help a little bit, but it's more about being flexible, respectful, and communicating when things change. We use things like whiteboards where we would write up something that had changed so that people could see it if we were co-located. Or we would communicate it via producers going to their daily stand-ups and noting that stuff had happened. Or they would overhear and then it would be reported around and then we'd decide what to do about it. But again, we're in chaos. We are in a chaos that we've invited upon ourselves and we need to be mindful of that. Things will change and people will annoy each other. But they're not doing it deliberately. They're doing it because making a game's really hard. And it's your job to smooth those edges over and to just calmly decide, okay, well, what should we do? Yeah, you're right. We've made our main character jump much higher and we need to remake the whole game from scratch. And we've got a month to go. Probably need to roll that back, don't you think? You don't need to put in change management. You not at this point, right? It could be at the very end when you're charging through QA, you're trying to fix things, you're blah, blah, blah. Or when you're locking down because you've got a milestone, it could be that you want some form of change management then. And it could be as simple as that. It could be Perforce lockdown. Tell us if you want to put any changes in. That's fine, right? That's a different thing. But you don't need to raise that as a risk or an issue. Expectations. If you're working with partners, publishers, let's say, other companies, you need to raise risks and issues around them and what they bring to you, and they will expect you to have risks and issues raised in order that they can have faith in you and trust that, for example, a publisher paying you money is putting that money in the right place. If you've got a big publisher paying you a whole bunch of cash and they're expecting monthly milestones, or they're expecting a vertical slice by a certain point, or they're expecting a game to be published on a certain date, or for you to be ready with the marketing team, and you're not going to be, they sure as hell want to know in advance. You keep risks and issues and you document them. You can show them, hey, last month we went through this risk here and you remember I told you these things. Here's the action we've taken. Here's what we've done. It's gone. We're back on track. Or it's now become an issue. We were not able to resolve this. We're talking to you now because here's the impact. Here's what that means. This is why you need risks and issues logged. And this is why you need to be transparent. Publishers, partners, in-source, outsource, they have expectations. They need to know that you're going to be ready to give them work. They need to know that that work's not going to suddenly change because you weren't ready, really. You just thought you'd throw something at them and it's all wasted, actually, just to give them something to do. Yeah, you need to avoid those sort of things. You need to plan ahead. If you're not ready, you need to tell them. Yeah, it's not a perfect world, is it? They might only be available for a certain specified amount of time if they're, say, an outsourcer, and they're going to make you some great videos for some trailers, and you're not ready on time, but they're not available. What are you going to do? Well, for a start, you're going to raise it as a possible risk once you see it coming, because then it's not a surprise. And it's very lean methodology to wait until you've got enough information and to gather as much information as you can before you need to make that decision. Get yourself as much information as you can. So we've covered some sort of basics here. Next time I want to actually run through a raid log with you and talk through it in more detail, and I will carry on rambling as I do. But I hope this is at least interesting and useful. Thank you.